Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Federal investigators have their hands full trying to spot all of the fraud schemes that cost the government billions every year. Imagine artificial intelligence-powered fraud and its potential for mischief. For more on that potential and how to stop it, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to the vice president and head of public sector strategy at Socure, Jordan Burris.
In recent years, what we've effectively seen is the continued rise in prevalence of sophisticated attacks to what would be our nation's, you know, identity infrastructure in particular, right? And so, you know, I recognize that a lot of the actions by the administration or even those of Congress are those that they've been talking about for quite a bit of time. And I'm, for one, glad to see them starting to take action in this space.
What are some of these schemes, I guess, that are AI powered? Is there, you know, any human engineering involved whatsoever? Or, you know, is it just a lot of code just going after other lines of code?
Right. So I would love to say that we were at a place where it's like the Terminator and AI is just thinking for itself. But generally, these are things that have been put into motion based on the actions of individuals at the end of the day. Right. So what we're seeing is that, you know, AI is being used at scale to think about it to accelerate activities that otherwise would be once manual and tedious. This could be everything from generating fake personas and identities to creating what would be images that allow for impersonation. In particular, this could be, you know, taking and finding ways to scramble, create PII and submit those on websites in order to intercept government benefits, for an example, especially those who are using weaker controls in particular. And so think of it as more of a tool. And unfortunately, when it comes to, you know, nation state actors or the criminal organizations, they're using this now more than ever to scale what they had been doing historically.
Yeah. Is this a system failure or is there some human error involved as well? Because, you know, personally, I can usually tell when I'm not talking to a real person.
You know, it's always very interesting. And so when we made the decision as a society to kind of embrace digital as a, you know, predominant channel for interacting, right? And we did this as consumers in particular, right? Because it was easier, it was more seamless for us. We kind of did away with some of that interaction that used to take place in person, all right? So you would always have to show up either at your bank or go and engage with some of your local grocery store, even in some cases, to, you know, participate in good and service. It was no different in government in particular. Now, I, for one, am not advocating to say that, hey, let's go back to things being very manual, because I would never actually get anything done. I'm absolutely terrible in some cases running errands around my house. But when we did away with that, we kind of still relied on some of those processes as they had been constructed at that moment in time, right? This reliance on whether it be government issued documents as they've been provided, the reliance on, you know, holding on to things such as our social security numbers and pretending that for some reason they've never been compromised or revealed in a data breach in some way, shape, or form, and other elements of our PII. And as such, a lot of the, we'll say, preventative measures that have been put in place historically have not evolved, right? And that has left us more susceptible. Now, I always hate to go back and look at the pandemic as a thing, but as a turning point or a turning moment for what happens with the digital ecosystem, that is kind of where you saw a lot of these controls start to break down or became more prevalent and understood the challenge that was going to be had, right? And this is what's led to billions of dollars in fraud today across a number of sectors, to include that of the public sector as well.
We're speaking with Jordan Burris. He is the head of public sector strategy for Socure. And so let's talk controls. What can be done to stop these new schemes that are popping up? Is it going to require an evolution of those controls that are already in place, or is some new technology going to have to be implemented?
So first and foremost, I think there's like a mindset shift that is required when it comes to this conversation, right? A lot of what the government has done or others have done is take a, I'm going to say, a pay and chase approach to this problem, right? Because the thought was always that, hey, if we, you know, got the funds out quickly, or if we, you know, made sure that the users on the other end of the screen ultimately got their benefit, in the event we got it wrong in any way, shape, or form, right, that we could claw that money back. Well, that continues to prove out over time. It's not easy to get this money back. Actually, a number, you know, larger amounts of funding that have been issued to individuals. You know, the government regularly reports on how, you know, even though they're increasing what would be law enforcement activities in order to recover it, they're only able to get but a fraction back of those funds. And so with shifting that mindset to away from pay a chase, then it's about taking preventative measures to see what we can do up front. Now, part of the discussion has been if we layer in too much security and we do too many things up front, unfortunately, we are going to put undue burden on the public when it comes to interacting and engaging with any digital system, right? How many times do you really want to be asked to take a picture of your driver's license in order to prove who you are, right? Or to take some other type of step or to show up in person or have a phone call into a call center, right? That becomes too burdensome. The reality is it doesn't even have to be that way, right? I would say that's even some in cases a legacy mindset shift that's taken place, no different than when we were talking about migrating technology platforms from being on-premise and moving them to the cloud. We actually had to rethink what it meant to restructure our technology solutions. We have to rethink what prevention may mean at scale and how you can actually be able to assess the risk of an individual doing so passively and only introducing some of these more burdensome checks or friction points when absolutely necessary to validating who they are, right? And so that becomes kind of the new discipline, the new art, if you will, that comes with, you know, being able to prove out individuals' identities. And it's something that, you know, much of what the administration is, you know, starting to call for is understanding we need to be taking some of these more preventative measures right out of the gate.
Yeah, I can only identify the pictures with bicycles in them so many times, Jordan, that after a while I get a little flustered. You know, and also it's a zero-sum game for the hackers themselves now, right? Because these tools have made it not only cheaper, but as you mentioned, less costly in time. So even if they're only able to get a fraction of what they take in a ransomware scheme or something like that, it's all profit, right?
Absolutely. And the interesting piece about them is that they're, of course, using it to funnel back into their criminal enterprises in order to continue to scale their offerings in particular, right? And note, they're not doing this alone. They're sharing insights with each other, right? They're discussing what happens and how certain solutions, systems, services that are being delivered, how they're porous and effectively how you each every single person who wants to partake in that type of scheme can actually engage with it in order to intercept benefits in particular, right? So they're highly networked. They're getting more and more sophisticated over time. To your point, the cost is going down in their ability to execute these attacks. And so more so now than ever, we need to be thinking about what could we be layering up front in order to basically fight back, right? Fight back with the same tools that are being used to circumvent our existing online services.
Jordan Burris is Vice President and Head of Public Sector Strategy at Socure, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. Find this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive and subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing. to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.